Well, good morning, everybody.
Good afternoon, well, morning.
Good morning, indeed. Let me get my microphone fixed up. So this is the last day of our class. We've got some fun topics to cover today. The microphone is a little bit strange, yeah? Let me see if I can fix that. So in terms of announcements, not much happening outside of this class today because the conference is being wrapped up. Today is probably the last day that you can add a certification or an on-demand bundle to your registration if you want. You can stop by the registration desk by 1:30 p.m. Or call the registration office by the end of Monday. If you want to ship books, there may be some boxes available at the SANS registration desk, but you would need to ship the books themselves through the business center on the first floor of the hotel. And lastly, if you're checking out today, make sure the hotel does not charge you for the internet. That's all I have in terms of announcements. Any questions or comments about what we've covered so far? Well, let's get going then. So I've got today split into covering two major topics. One that we're gonna, well, all of them are gonna be presented in the context of malware that is trying to defend itself from the analysis. And the first half of today, we're going to be looking at compiled Windows executables that are pretty well packed. And I'm going to show you several techniques for how to bypass their protection. And the second half of today, we're going to revisit some of the techniques for obfuscating malicious browser scripts, both using JavaScript and using VBScript, and I'm going to show you some additional tools that we have not had a chance to cover yet. So that's what awaits us today. Learn how to handle more complex packers and more complex script obfuscation than what we've already covered. To remind you of a good way to get started processing a packed executable, well, we want to find out what packer is likely to have been used to protect it. And several ways of identifying packers. You may remember some of these from before. Let me see. There's a bit of an echo here, right? Yeah. How do we begin dealing with a packed executable? Well, first try to find out what packer was used to protect it. This way you can research it, and maybe you're going to get instructions for how to bypass its protections. And the good news is that a lot of these packers don't try to conceal their identity from you, because in a way, this is advertising for them. If you know that the packer is being used in the wild, well, maybe you're going to recommend it to your friends, or maybe you're going to end up using it yourself as well. So it's not surprising that a lot of these packed executables that have been protected using commercial packers, if you just look at strings embedded into the executables, you're going to find the name of the packer that was used. So, for example, the section names that we can look at using specialized tools are also going to be visible as plain strings. And I already showed you that UPX names its sections UPX0, UPX1, etc. ASPAC, in many cases, will name its sections ASPAC and ADATA. NSPAC will call its sections NSP0, NSP1. So in many cases, if you notice a name of a section that's a little bit anomalous, even if the name does not spell out the name of the tool, you can Google it and find out what packer was used. And then you can research that packer to see how to bypass its protection. Some other embedded strings that might identify how the executable was protected or encoded. Ntkernel is a pretty advanced packer. We're going to look at it today. Well, it's very verbose about its presence if you look at the strings. Pcompact has its name as one of the strings. Themida, or Themida, depending on how you choose to pronounce it, also embeds its name as one of the strings. So in many cases, if these generic commercial packers are used, which are pretty popular, you'll be able to find out what they're called and research them. Sometimes, keep in mind that you might not be dealing with an advanced packer. You might be dealing with just a self-extractable, regular, compressed executable, in which case the attacker may have used WinZip or WinRAR. In those cases, often you can tell by looking at the names of the string, but by looking at the strings, what was used to compress the executable. GNU file utility is part of many Unix distributions, most of them, and I was surprised to learn that file is able to recognize some of the common packers. And this is a utility that you run from the command line, and You just type file and then give it the name of the executable, and it's going to show you which packer was used. It has not a very large, but a decent database of common packers. So in this case, it was able to identify PCompact, NullSoft installer, UPX, for example. But perhaps the most reliable way of detecting a packer is using the PID database. We looked at PID before. I told you that it has a pretty sizable database that it often comes with. And also, I found a much larger database that I have given you as part of your PID installation. Well, PID on Windows is a GUI tool, but there are some scripts available for you through which you can scan an executable on the command line using the PID database. So I have such a script installed on Remnix. You're welcome to use it. It requires Python, so you could install it on Windows as well if you install Python there. But it's already installed on Remnix. All you need to do to use it is type PID on the command line, point it to the executable, and it's going to identify it if it has a signature for it in its database. This is a script that was written by Jim Clausing, and it actually uses a really cool module that Eric Carrera wrote that allows you to parse Windows executables using Python scripts. So at this point, we may have identified a packer. We may have researched it. And if you found instructions for how to unpack it, your job is going to be reasonably simple. But in many cases, you maybe were unable to identify a packer and I just don't really know where to begin. Or maybe you've identified a packer, but there is very little information available to you for how to unpack it. Let's look at some examples to see how to manually unpack reasonably complex executables. So if you recall what we did yesterday, and I hope you do recall, we assumed that the executable was not packed, right? We were able to cleanly load it into a debugger, into a disassembler, look at its code, look at its strings, look at its API calls. Well, many executables that you will deal with will be packed, and I want to show you some approaches for unpacking them. Once you've unpacked them, then you can do the kind of analysis that we did yesterday. So what I'm going to be focusing on today is how to unpack them. In fact, that's all we're going to be looking at in the first half of today. I'm going to assume that once you've unpacked them, then you can bring it into a disassembler and start analyzing it. So I'm going to focus specifically on heuristic techniques and tips and tricks for unpacking executables. It's a challenging topic to cover because it's hard to come up with a generic way for unpacking an executable. Every packer is a little bit different. Authors of these packing utilities try to be creative, and so they keep you on your toes. That's why I don't really have a generic step-by-step process that you can follow to unpack an executable. I just couldn't come up with one because every unpacker is a little bit different. But what I can present to you are several techniques and corresponding tools that you can use in many cases to unpack programs. How you use these techniques, in what combination, well, that's going to depend on which packer was used. So that's what I'm going to show you. Not how to unpack every single thing that you're going to find out there, but a few useful techniques that I think will help you in the real world. And we're going to start off with some real world examples. So let's fire up your Windows Virtual Machine. If you don't have it already, please start it up. You don't need to be infected, so you can revert back to when your system was nice and clean. Just make sure that you don't lose any of the tools that you've already installed there. So I'm going to start up my virtual machine as well. And on your DVD, in the malware day 4 subdirectory, you're going to find a sample called Windows XP 2. Please extract it onto the desktop of your Windows virtual machine, because we're going to spend some time analyzing this one. It's called Windows XP 2. It's under malware / day 4. So for this, we're just going to use Windows. You don't really need to have Remnix running. We will be using Remnix in the second half of today, but not in the first half. I'm just going to show you one quick little thing on Remnix while you're booting up your Windows virtual machines. We're using the same Windows virtual machine that you've been using so far. So, and that's the one that should be Windows XP. And it should be at least patched to Service Pack 2, because some of the tools don't work unless you have Service Pack 2 or Service Pack 3. So I'm going on to day 4. Windows XP2 is the sample we're analyzing now. So I usually start off by looking at the strings embedded into the executable, because this can give me a sense for how likely is it that the executable was packed. And if you look at the strings using bintext that are in this executable, you're going to notice that there's very little information available to you. That's because it is packed. Very few visible strings in there. There are some, but not much. So now I can load it into PEID, and PEID is able to scan it using its signature database, and it identifies the packer. It says, this is PCompact 2. That's good, because now we can research this and find out some tips that maybe people have documented for how to bypass this particular packer. Similarly, let me show you how you can do this also from Remnix, if you have this executable on Remnix. There's a script that I mentioned earlier called packerid, and I'm going to scan Windows XP2.exe with it. And again, because it uses the same database of signatures, it identified the packer as PCompact 2. But this lends itself nice to scripting, so I like having this command line tool. There's also another tool that I thought I'd mention to you that is also installed on Remnix. I don't have this in the book. The tool is called Trid. And Trid is another tool. It's similar to file. It's a pretty good tool for identifying what kind of a file are you dealing with. Is this a Windows executable? Is this an HTML file? Is this a PDF file? The command file can do that. Let me show you what people normally use. File, let's say Windows XP2.exe. And in this case, file just identifies this as a Windows executable. File, in this case, is unable to identify the particular packer. Trid is a bit more elaborate than file. It is installed on Remnix, though it's not part of most distributions, but I did install it. And if you look at file, at Trid, it gives you a little bit more information about an executable. What it does is it actually gives you statistical analysis. So it's not very definitive about its answers, but it gives you probabilities. When it scanned this executable, it said that there's a 50% chance that it's a Windows executable and a 49.9% chance that it's a DOS executable. So in this particular case, it's probably not very accurate. But in other situations, I found that using Trid is really good if there's some kind of a file that was downloaded, and I just don't even know what kind of a file is it. If I want to quickly assess for the type of a file that is, I use both file and Trid. Sometimes one works better than the other. So I thought I'd mention this to you. But in this case, we scanned it, we identified the packer. I'm going to proceed with my analysis under the assumption that we were unable to find any hints on the internet for how to deal with this packer. Even though if you were to search the internet now, you'd find some hints for this particular packer. But let's say that we're dealing with an executable and nobody's helping us out. We're on our own. How do we proceed? Well, if you try to load this executable into OliDebug, you will see why you need to bypass the packer's protection. Let me show you what happens when you try to load this executable into OliDebug. It's going to ask you a question, and it's very important that you answer this question correctly. That's why let me show this to you first before you do this. When you load the executable into OliDebug, it presents this question to you. It says, quick statistical test of module Windows X reports that the code is either compressed, encrypted, or contains large amount of embedded data. Results of the code analysis will be unreliable or simply wrong. Do you want to continue code analysis? Whenever OliDebug asks you this question, always say no. If you say yes, OliDebug will get confused. It's going to misinterpret what is code, what is data, and the results that it's going to show you are just going to confuse you. So OliDebug is pretty good about knowing its own limitations. So if OliDebug tells you that I think I might be unable to handle this compressed code, just answer no. It'll still do a reasonable job analyzing the executable, but it won't dig very deep into the executable. That's okay. If OLEDebug asks you this question about analyzing compressed code, say, no, I don't want to do it. So let me do that. And now I've loaded this packed executable into OLEDebug. The reason I know it's packed is because there are very few visible strings, and also because PID told me that it was packed. Go ahead and load this executable into OLEDebug. When it asks you about analyzing compressed code, say no. And once you do this, I'm going to show you that in just the very few instructions, the very few first instructions that executable like this one is executing, you're dealing with a malware defensive measure. So I'm going to show you this anti-analysis technique, and I think it's kind of cool. So let me give you a minute to load this into OLEDebug. So the three tools that I showed you on Linux, and it was probably hard to see from the back, were file, trid, and packer ID. Packer ID is the command line version of PEID, and I use it to scan executables with a PEID database. It's called packer ID. And the other tools is spelled trid, T-R-I-D. It is similar to file, but it uses a different statistics-based technique for identifying executables. The nice thing about trid is that you can train it yourself. You can give it a bunch of executables, and it can automatically build up its own statistical database based on the samples that you feed it. So take a look at trid. It's available for Unix. It also runs on Microsoft Windows. So it's a pretty cool tool that I thought I'd share with you. T-R-I-D, trid. So once you've loaded this executable into OLEDebug, here are the instructions that OLEDebug shows you. And as you might expect, when the program starts running, it's going to start executing these instructions. What I want to show you is that what you're looking at is not what it may seem to be. You're looking at a pretty common defensive measure that I want to make sure you learn how to deal with. To understand what we see here, let's actually step through these few instructions in the beginning of the program. We're going to start by executing the move instruction. What do you think it's going to do? This first instruction, move. Well, it actually does what you think it will do. It'll take this address, 519870, and it's going to place it into the EIX register. Remember that we're listing the destination first. So once this instruction is executed, this address, 519870, is going to be stored within EIX. Let me execute this on my screen so that you can see this in action. And I'm going to give you some time to play with this a little bit later. Let me try to increase my font size. Appearance, fonts, let's see. Let me do change, yeah. So it's 7, let me turn it into, that's an ugly font. Courier new. All right, let's try Courier new. 14. Oh boy. Okay, that's not, yeah, it's ugly, but you know what? It's visible. Is that easier to see from the back a little bit? Okay. So, I'm going to execute the first move instruction. To do this, I'm stepping through the program. I can press either F7 or F8. The only difference is if I'm about to make a call, then F7 is going to step into that function and execute all of its instructions. F8 is going to skip over that function and execute it in a single step. So I'm going to say, I don't know, F7. In this case, it doesn't matter. And look at this. After I've executed that instruction, EIX contains 519870 as we thought we would. All right, that's not very exciting. What's the next instruction going to do? The push instruction. Yeah, it's going to push contents of EIX onto the stack, and the stack is visible at the bottom right corner of your screen. So let me execute that instruction. I'm going to press F7, And now you see on top of the stack is the value that was in EAX, 519870. That's the value that's on top of the stack. All right, so far pretty straightforward. And any questions about this so far? If you have any questions, please ask. All right, now the next instruction, the third instruction, is a little bit harder to read. It's a push instruction. We're saving something on top of the stack, but what are we saving to the stack? Let me explain. We're dealing with structured exception handling here. How do I know that? Because of the reference to FS0. So let's remember how structured exception handling works. I mentioned to you that SEH, structured exception handling, is a process that Windows uses to handle unexpected problems that occur. Let's say that this program crashes. How will Microsoft Windows know which exception handlers to invoke? Well, here's how Windows does it. What it will do is it will look at a particular memory location for the thread that has crashed. That memory location is stored in the FS segment at its zeroth offset. So in all the time, whenever you see FS0, FS0 stores in it the address of the beginning of the exception handling chain. You may recall from yesterday that exception handling records are linked to each other because more than one exception handling record may need to be examined when a problem occurs. FS0 stores the address where the first exception handling record is stored by definition. So whenever you see FS0, right away you should be thinking this has something to do with exception handling. So what's going to happen when I execute this third instruction is that the address of the first exception handling record that is currently stored in FS0, that address will be placed on top of the stack. You might be wondering, how do I look at the exception handling records? Well, if you go to View, there's an option called SEH chain. This will show you the current SEH records. Right now, there's a single SEH handler defined. It was defined by Microsoft Windows. Our program did not define it explicitly. This is what is stored in FS0. Right now, when an error occurs, this SEH handler will be invoked. What the program that we're looking at is doing is it is defining its own brand new exception handler. And what you're looking at is the code that implements it. I will show you why this is important in just a few minutes. So let me execute this third instruction. I press F7, and now look at what's on top of the stack. The value 12FFE0. It was taken from FS0, and if you look, 12FFE0 is indeed what was shown to us in the SEH chain window. So what have we done so far? We've just placed two values on top of the stack. One of the values is an address of some code within the program that we're debugging, and the other element that's on top of the stack is the address of the current exception handling function. Why is this important? Because these two records are forming a brand new SEH record. You may recall from yesterday that an exception handling record contains two elements. One is a pointer to the exception handling function, and the other one is a pointer to the next exception handling record. What the code that you're looking at is doing is defining a brand new SEH record. What it wants to do is define a new SEH record so that when a problem occurs, a function at the address 519870 gets invoked. Why does it want to do that? It's a defensive technique that you will understand very shortly. So what this program is doing is defining a new SEH record so that when a problem occurs, this function is invoked, 519870. To define a record, it needs to place two values on the stack. The address of the function that it wants to be the SEH handler, but that's not enough. It also needs to create a pointer to the next exception handling record. And the next exception handling record will be the one that is currently in place. That's why it copied that value from FS0. And there's only one thing that it needs to do now to define officially this SEH record. And that's what the next instruction is going to be for. Look at what it does. It's a move instruction, and it saves ESP into FS0. What is at ESP? It points to the top of the stack. It points to here, the top of the stack. And what we're doing is we're saving the pointer to the top of the stack into FS0. Why? Because after this move instruction executes, when a problem occurs, Microsoft Windows will look into FS0, will see a pointer to this part of the stack, and it will treat this as the SEH record, and it will invoke the exception handler 519870. So let me show you. I'm going to execute this next move instruction. And now, OliDebug actually is able to notice that what's on the stack is an SEH record, and SC handler pointer is sending us to 519870. And if I show you the other window that I've been tracking, the SCH chain window, now we've got two SCH handlers on it. One that was there before, pointing to kernel 32, and the other one is pointing to 519870. This is the exception handler that we just defined. Why do we care about this? Because of what's about to happen. What this malicious program is going to do, now that it's defined the SCH handler, is that now it's going to crash itself. The program is going to purposefully crash itself. What's Windows going to do? It's going to say, oops, there's a problem. Let me evoke an exception handler. Which exception handler? Well, the first one in the chain is 519870, so Windows will execute this function, and malware will continue executing from within this function. This is a very tricky jump, because if you don't realize that this is what's happening here, you may look at this code statically and you will say, well, there are no jumps here, there are no calls, I guess it's going to continue executing sequentially. No, no. What's happening here is that it's using the SCH handling mechanism as a tricky jump into the function 519870. Yes, a question or a comment? Why is there a second exception handling record? Well, it is common to have multiple exception handling records because Windows will walk through the chain and multiple exception handlers may need to be invoked to address a problem because problems often have cascading effects.
Is that sequentially or is it same?
I believe it's gonna invoke it sequentially, so it's gonna go through it starting from the very beginning. So in this case, the first one is gonna be 519870, and the reason Windows defined this one is that it's basically a catch-all. If the program doesn't define its own, then at least Windows will invoke some exceptional handler within kernel 32. So let me finish executing this, because now that the exception handling record has been defined, the program is going to crash itself. How is it going to do that? In two instructions. What's the next one going to do? XOR EAX with EAX. Anybody remembers?
Zero.
It zeroes out the values of EAX. I mentioned to you that one of the common ways of zeroing out the value of a register is by XORing it with itself. So right now, EAX is a non-zero value. Let me execute this one by pressing F7. Or F8, it doesn't matter. If you look at EAX, it is now set to zero. Now, look at what the next instruction is going to do. It's a move instruction. It's going to move contents of ECX into some place in memory. What is that place in memory? Well, EAX is set to zero. So where it's trying to write is the very beginning of the data segment. Guess what? Nobody's allowed to write there. This is a sure way to cause a program to crash because Windows won't let you write to the very beginning of that segment. Not allowed. And look at what happens when I execute this instruction. At the bottom left corner of my screen, an error message appears. Access violation when writing to zero. You can't write there. The program has crashed. Now, if this had occurred outside of OliDebug, the user, or the victim in this case, wouldn't notice any problems because this problem would be handled by Microsoft Windows. This crash will occur, but Windows will recover gracefully by invoking the SCH handler. So it's going to look at FS0. It's going to notice that the first SCH handler is this function, and it's going to execute that function. pretty tricky. Because when you look at that code, you don't realize that it is actually going to execute this function. But that's what actually will happen. And this is a very, very common technique. So you need to be able to recognize it. You need to be familiar with how CH records are defined using these instructions. And the easiest thing to look out for is references to FS0. Yes?
So let me just kind of...
It may need to execute multiple exception handlers to finish the recovery, but in this case, that won't be necessary. All the program is trying to do is to convince Windows to execute this particular function, and so the malicious program will continue executing as if nothing has happened from within this function.
But the program itself hasn't recovered.
It's well, has the program recovered? The definition of recovery is very ambiguous. In this case, recovery just means that the program continues to run. It's just that in this case, it's continuing to run from this particular function.
Okay, so yeah. Instruction.
Yeah, it just is going to execute the first instruction in this particular function, and everything will be nice and dandy. Yeah. Yes?
So you got enough space right in the start there with knobs in front of
it. Oh, so you're already thinking, well, how to bypass this defense, right?
Yeah.
You might be able to say, you know what, just get rid of all this junk and insert your own manual call into this function. That's one way to approach this, as long as you make sure that the stack is in the proper state that the program expects it to be. But a slightly easier way to do this, let me show you how I typically do it if I want to debug, continue debugging from within this function. Yeah. Is this something that a programmer programmed, or is this the packer's functionality? Usually it will be the packer that implemented this functionality because it wants to really make your job hard. Mm-hmm. So let me show you how I typically handle something like this. I'm going to start from the beginning. So debug, restart. Yes, I want to restart. No, I don't want to analyze. And so what I'm going to do, what I would do typically here is I would look at this block of code. I would notice that this is FS0, and to me that's an indicator that I need to step through this carefully. Now, realize that not all exception handlers are bad for you. Many regular non-malicious programs use exception handling. But when I see FS0 in the context of malware, right away I'm a little bit suspicious, so I execute this carefully, and I keep an eye out on the SCH chain window. So I'm going to continue executing this, but there is one more thing that I need to do actually before I can properly debug this. And that is an option that I will need to change under options, debugging options. There's a tab there called exceptions. Let me show you how it needs to be defined and explain to you why we need to be able to do this. This is the options window that you get in OliDebug if you go to debugging options, exceptions. This is where you can tell OliDebug how to handle exceptions. And what I configure my OliDebug to do is to basically pretend like, well, OliDebug calls it ignore exceptions. I'm saying ignore all possible exceptions. What does it mean to ignore an exception? It's another way of saying if an exception occurs, don't ask me what I should do. Automatically invoke the corresponding exception handling function. So if an exception occurs, with these options, OliDebug will automatically invoke that exception handling function. So what I would like you to do now in OliDebug is to please go into debugging options, exceptions tab, and enable all of these options so that those exceptions that could be ignored will be ignored by OliDebug. This way, if a malicious program does use this tricky jump, OliDebug will just follow the execution the way Microsoft Windows would if the debugger wasn't present. In addition to enabling all of these checkboxes, you also need to add a custom exception range, the way I'm showing you on the screen, that starts from 0 and goes all the way until 8 Fs. FF, 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 FF. So when you're done, your setup should resemble what you're seeing on the screen. So to add this range, let's say I did not already have it defined. So what you would need to do is you would say also ignore the following custom range, add range starting from 0 all the way to FF, 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 FF. Now, at this point, you might want to take another snapshot. because you will want to revert later on in the experiments, and it'll be convenient for you not to have to do this again. So if you can take multiple snapshots in your setup, take another snapshot so that it, your setup remembers this particular setting. You can exit all the debug if you want to make sure that your system is truly not infected. So with this setup, the way I'm showing you on the screen, this will help you deal with a lot of these tricky exception handlers, because OliDebug will just automatically end up invoking the exception handling function instead of trying to catch that exception and ask you what you want to do with it. This helps you pretend like the debugger isn't really there. All right, so with this setting enabled, here's what I'm going to do. When I'm analyzing this program, I notice that there is FS0, and let's say I want to actually step through debugging that function. Well, the way I'm going to do it is as follows. I'm going to execute these instructions one by one that define the exception handler. And as soon as I notice that the new exception handler was defined for me, I'm going to set a breakpoint on the exception handling function in the SCH chain window. To set a breakpoint, I click on that SCH handler that the malicious program defined, and now I just set my breakpoint there. For some reason, OliDebug won't let you right-click to set your breakpoint. It doesn't give you that option. That's okay, but you just need to set the breakpoint by pressing F2. F2 will work just fine, so I'm going to press F2. OliDebug finds that this breakpoint is suspicious. That's okay, it'll work. So I'm going to say yes, I do really want to set this breakpoint. Now I've set the breakpoint on the SCH handler. And now I'm simply going to run my program. It's going to crash itself, but it doesn't matter, because Windows will invoke this SCH handler, and that's when my breakpoint will have been reached, and I continue stepping through the program as I would normally. So I'm going to now click Run, and it runs, and look at where it brings me. It pauses almost immediately in the beginning of that function, 519870, and now it can continue stepping through the program to try to understand what it does. Yes?
Could you have also just gone to that spot and put a breakpoint there?
Could I have also just gone to that spot, maybe doing Control G? Yep, that's possible, yeah. A lot of ways to do this, of course. Yeah, I'm just showing you kind of what I find the easiest, but everybody's got their own style. So I would like to give you some time to experiment with this, to make sure you understand this. I want you to both understand how assembly defines SCH records, so that you can notice when this happens to you. And I also want you to be able to set the breakpoint so that you find yourself within the SCH handling function, so that if you wanted to, you can continue tracing the executable. So the instructions for this begin on page 15 in your fourth book, and they take us all the way until page 20. So, 15 through 20. As you step through this code, if it is unclear to you how it works, just let me know and I'll be glad to go over it with you. So, we're not going very far right now. Just, I want to make sure that you're able to debug this SCH handling code and you understand how it works. 15 until 20. Continue. So to clarify one thing based on some of the questions that I ask, there are a few things that I wanted you to learn based on this particular exercise. One is I wanted you to be aware of this tricky jump, so that when you look at a code like this, you don't think that it's going to continue executing sequentially and don't waste your time analyzing the code below. I want you to be able to recognize that this is a tricky code to invoke a function 519870. And so now I also want you to be able to do, what I want you to be able to do is to analyze what that function does. To do that, there are several ways of getting into this function to continue stepping through it dynamically. The easiest way is to set a breakpoint on it after it's defined as an SCH handler, so that then you find yourself within that function and can continue stepping through the program to understand what it does. That's what I wanted you to take out of this exercise. And now if we want to, we can continue stepping through the program to see what it does and how it operates. So any questions about this approach and the way this technique works and about how we used OLLIDEBUG to bypass this defense.